Whether our memories of our school days are fond ones or memories that produce winces, they are not that different from the memories of students who attended school more recently. Teacher in front of classroom, rows of desks, all the usual attributes that we expect from schools. Hasn't been a lot of change over centuries, actually. And that is part of the debate over how schools should be evolving over time. Our next guest has a few ideas conveyed in the book Creative Schools, the grassroots revolution that's transforming education. Ken Robinson, Ph.D., now Sir Ken Robinson, was professor of education for 12 years at the University of Warwick in England. He's been writing and speaking about education and how to change it for decades. His 2006 TED Talk, Do Schools Kill Creativity, is the single most watched TED Talk in history. Creative Schools and two previous books were co-written and researched with Lou Aronica. Creative Schools came out last year and in paperback yesterday. Dr. Robinson, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
What would you say is the primary mistake that people make in wanting to reform schools?
I think it's the belief that it can be done through a kind of remorseless process of testing, particularly standardized testing. You know, those sorts of tests where you give them four choices and it's like a bubble test, and so they can be processed very quickly. It's that, the idea that you can transform education just by testing and testing and testing around certain disciplines. It's turned into in America, to be a multi-billion dollar industry, and it hasn't worked. You know, it's not produced the results and improvements in schools that were anticipated, certainly not the ones that were being claimed for it. And on the contrary, it's actually demoralized lots of kids, it's disaffected teachers, and it simply has not improved schools in the way that was expected by the people who recommended it. I mean, I think anyone who knows about education never thought it would, but it hasn't worked. I think that's been proved in America, and it used to be one of the biggest problems.
But the counter-argument is that you have to measure student progress and school progress somehow. I mean, how would you do it without tests, with these tests anyway?
No, absolutely you do. And by the way, I ought to say, Jeff, I mean, I live in America now. I've lived here for 15 years. You know, I don't want you to think I've just kind of popped over, you know.
No, you're in L.A., I get that.
Suburbs
yeah.
of London to have a go at you. You know, I travel all across the country, and I visit schools, work with teachers and school districts, and, you know, and I'm an educator myself. I'm not speaking criticism of teachers or schools or individual head teachers or superintendents, but I'm saying there's a problem in the system that people who work in it know is wrong as well, and they complain about it. So let me be clear about this. No, I'm not arguing against raising standards, of course not. I mean, why would you? I mean, we need to raise standards always in education as everywhere else, and there's no good reason to lower them. And I'm not arguing personally, some people would, but I don't personally argue against all forms of standardized testing. It's about getting them in their proper place. You know, I was saying recently, if I have a medical exam, as I do, you know, once a year, I want some standardized tests. You know, I want to know what my cholesterol level is compared to everybody else's. I don't want my doctor to tell me the result in some personal scale he invented in the car on the way to work. You know, I don't tell me my cholesterol is level orange. You know what I mean?
Right.
It really doesn't help me. But as a diagnostic tool, you know, occasional testing here and there, just as a kind of taking the temperature, kind of litmus test, of course, that can be very helpful. Good teachers are also completely aware of the importance of assessment, and anyone who sees the scale and cost and importance of public education will want people who work in it to be accountable, of course. So it's just that this system doesn't do it. This is overreach. I mean, for a lot of kids in school now, their lives are dominated by the prospect of these tests looming up. They get very stressed out about them. Teachers have become, in some cases, glorified test administrators for a large part of their year. And a lot hangs on these, you know, funding, whether schools are kept open or closed. And it's a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's out of control, I think. It's completely out of hand. And it's not an argument against having any form of testing, but this is just it's just gone too far, and it hasn't worked. And it's absorbing too much energy and too much money. And it's time, really, that people woke up to the need for the alternative. A lot of teachers have always known that, but I think politically we need to realize this hasn't worked.
Early in the book, you give an anecdote about visiting an abattoir, a slaughterhouse, when you were younger in England. you certainly get our attention there. What's the analogy you're drawing here?
Well, no, my point is that education you know, mass education, mass public education, in, not just in America, but worldwide, has not been around since the dawn of time. I mean, on the contrary, most of these systems came into being relatively recently, historically. They came into being in the mid to late 19th century, and they came into being very largely because of the need to educate a different sort of workforce for the Industrial Revolution. You know, millions of people moved to cities during the Industrial Revolution in the 17th and 18th centuries and into the 19th century, and it was a progress that saw people leaving the land, gathering in cities, to be part of this new enterprise of industrial manufacturing. So the vast majority of people needed to do blue-collar work, and then we needed a smaller group to do office work and administration and be the professional classes. You know, so that's why we had a very broad base of elementary education and a very narrow tip of university education. It was modeled on the needs of the economy at the time. Now, this wasn't the only factor, but it was a big factor. And if you look at the way schools have been organized since then, they've been infused with this sort of factory mentality. I mean, for example, in high schools, the day is carved up into different segments of time. You know, bells ring, people move around the building in cohorts. We educate kids in age groups. You know, all the 5-year-olds, all the 6-year-olds, all the 10-year-olds, all the 11-year-olds shunt through the system with their age group. We don't do that anywhere else, by the way. I mean, outside schools, we don't keep all the 11-year-olds in a separate compound, you know, and say, please don't talk to 15-year-olds. It won't be good for you. This is just something that happens in school. It's not an educational principle. It's an organizational principle. And then it's based on conformity, and it's kind of regular testing to see if people are making the grade. And if you don't make the grade, then there may be remedial programs. So it's an industrial system, and that's why it needs to change.
More analysis of what exists now and what could exist in the future, and what already does exist in some cases. There are some great examples in Ken Robinson's book, Creative Schools, The Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. We'll come back and talk more with Ken and take phone calls and emails from you if you have stories to share or questions to ask. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Robinson and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Ken Robinson, Sir Ken Robinson in the UK. He is a longtime discusser, debater, lecturer about education and where it should be going. His latest book is called Creative Schools, The Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. It is out in paperback as of yesterday. You can join our discussion on the Exchange and listen to the ideas that he presents about education and ask questions of him and share some stories of your own if there are particularly effective methods of teaching you've seen over the years. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So coming back, Ken, to the industrial revolution model of schools that basically was set up to stock what jobs were in existence at the time, let me carry the analogy a little further. I mean, is modern schooling, in your opinion, a bit like General Motors in the 70s, cranking out the lemons?
Well, I think the analogy only goes so far, and it's one of the things I argue in the book, that it's important to recognize that educating kids, however much the system and the testing system may want to depersonalize it, we have to recognize that education is a very personal process, and that if it doesn't work unless you engage the talents and the interests and the dispositions of kids individually. You know, we're all very different. We all have very different talents, and we have very different possibilities in our lives, and education should be doing that. The problem, where the analogy holds, is that the system is based implicitly on a very narrow view of ability, and because of that, we invent quite a big idea of disability or inability. It's why so many smart people go through school and end up feeling not very smart as a consequence. You know, they feel they're not very good at anything, or they just didn't make the cut. And you know, in America, it depends, Jeff, how you count these things, but or how you define it. But across the country, on average, the numbers of kids who start the ninth grade and don't graduate the 12th grade hover, you know, somewhere around 20%. I could just go on how you define it. In some areas, it's very much higher than that. It's 60% or more. In others, it's less, of course. But I'm carefully avoiding the word dropout here because I don't like the word dropout. It implies that if you drop out, that you failed the system. I think when so many people don't get through the system, it's probably reasonable to ask whether the system has failed them. Because my experience is that most kids want to be educated. There are lots of examples in the book. Kids want to learn. They have an appetite for it, but they don't have an appetite for the sort of school system they're being put through, or the teachers feel too stressed out to attend to them properly. And if you change the system, then you change their expectation. That's my point. You asked about the abattoir thing. I mean, it's a light analogy, but I was just saying I went round this thing in my 20s. You know, an abattoir is a factory designed to kill animals, and it works. I mean, very few of them escape and form survivors clubs, you know. And I remember going around this thing, you know, but bear in mind, you know, half my family are vegetarian or vegan, so I went around just to take a look at it. And at the end of it, there was a door that, with a sign on that said veterinarian. And I thought, well, that's a bit late, you know, and this guy must be fairly depressed at the end of an average week, you know. So I said, so why don't you have a veterinarian come in? And the guy showed me around and said, well, he comes in every once in a while to conduct random autopsies. And I thought, well, he must have seen the pattern by now, surely. I mean, another 2,000 dead animals today. There's something going on in here. I'm going to get to the bottom of it. And I said, you know, my point is, if you design a system with certain features to do certain things, then don't be surprised if it does it. And if you design a school system that's predicated on a certain type of conformity, a certain view of intelligence, if you set a narrow set of criteria for what counts as success, then don't be surprised if a lot of people come through it feeling they haven't done very well. And this isn't all about giving everybody a trophy and saying everybody's terrific when they may not have done well. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that human talent is very broad-ranging. I mean, look at the way America has thrived, you know, since its inception as an independent country. It's been a country that's really encouraged individual initiative, creativity, entrepreneurship, talent in all sorts of fields. And great communities depend on that. We want people who are interested in doing all sorts of different things. You know, we need great surgeons, we need great teachers, you know, but we also need people who love to work in the community. We need people who are writers and poets and dancers. We need people who are designers. We need people who want to work with the elderly and people who are suffering from mental illnesses. You know, we want all these sorts of people. We depend upon them. But if you have a system of education that is really focused on getting certain kids to perform well so they can go to an Ivy League college, then you've created a very narrow funnel. And inevitably, you create a lot. I mean, that's where the analogy holds good. You develop a lot of waste products, these people who fall out the system and feel that they have failed. And then you create a big social problem as a consequence. I mean, it would be wrong to say, wouldn't it, that if you don't graduate high school, you end up in jail. That's not true. Of course it's not true. What is true is a very high proportion of people in the correctional system did not complete high school. That's a matter of fact. And that pipeline, as it's sometimes called, is a very costly thing, which profits some people who are actually, you know, doing well out of the commercial prison system. But it's a catastrophic way to treat our young people. And it creates problems that we could avoid if we change the system. And that's the analogy. The system creates the problems. If you change the system, these problems tend to dissipate or disappear entirely.
Ken Robinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Creative Schools, The Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. You use the word narrow a couple of times now, and it forces me to think about something that comes up later in the book when you note with some criticism the term alternative education, that we don't. And I think the point you're trying to make is that that there needs to be more alternative, that rather than having this narrow pipeline of, like, this is what you do. You go into a class with 25 other kids, 30 other kids in some cases, and learn the same stuff at the same time. You're suggesting it needs to be a lot more closely tailored than that.
Yeah, it needs to be much more personalized, much more customized. I often ask people as I go around these days, you know, giving talks or working with groups, if they've got children. I'll ask people listening to the program now, if you've got two children or more, I'll make you a bet, and I'll win it. I'm confident I'll win it. If you've got two children or more, I bet you they are completely different from each other. And they will be, because they are even identical twins. The people who know them, and certainly to each other, are different personalities. They may be similar in all sorts of ways, but people who know them well know they're very different. And certainly kids who are not, you know, identical twins or twins, or all children are different. We have different talents, different interests. It's one of the great pleasures of life that our interests and talents are so diverse. So it's not, I'm not arguing against academic work, but our system is predicated on the idea of academic ability, which is a particular style of critical thinking. It's important. I mean, I used to teach in universities. I'm all over it. I like academics. But I also work with dancers, with musicians, with engineers, with technologists, and they have other ways of thinking and acting in the world, and we need all of that for our community to thrive. So, you know, to me, it would be a bit, Jeff, it'd be a bit like having a national sports program, like schools were just devoted to sports. But, you know, the only sport we know, because we're told it in every way, the way people are selected, the way they're tested, you know, that the only sport that really matters is hockey, you know, really. And we're looking for the hockey players, obviously. So we're testing for hockey all the time, and we're giving people, you know, hockey sticks to go out and play with. And if you don't make the grade in hockey, well, we've got remedial programs in basketball and football and tennis, you know, but... You know, but they're the people who don't quite make the cut. Well, it's absurd if you put it that way, isn't it? But that's what we do with our kids, other forms of intelligence. You know, we say to the dancers, the musicians, the poets, the writers, the designers, the people who, what people who want to be business entrepreneurs, you know, the people who want to work in the community, we say to them, well, there are other programs you can take, but we're really interested in the people who are going to go to college and do a law degree or going to be academics. And you might say that's fanciful, but look at how the system works. You know, look at the messages people get about what they're meant to be good at. And if you have a narrow view of ability, you end up with a big conception of inability. And it's why so many people leave college thinking they're not, leave school thinking they're not very smart. And my argument is that instead of saying to people, how intelligent are you, and have this narrow idea in mind, we ought to be saying, how are you intelligent? You know, how does it show itself? I mean, look at the work you do. It depends on all kinds of expertise and subtleties and nuances, you know, getting people on and connecting them and communicating with the audience. I don't know what your own career path was, but I bet you weren't thinking of doing this when you were, well, I can't bet that. I might lose that bet. but were you thinking about this, you know, when you started high school? Or, I mean, how did you get into it?
I was thinking of doing sports when I was in high school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened?
Sports people can be horrendously difficult to deal with. It's a lot easier to talk to educators. That's one of the reasons. But, I mean, a lot of other things along the way, too. I mean, I was looking for ways to express creativity, too, as we all are, which is why this really rings a bell with a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, that's my point, you see, that every human life is different. You know, we all have different biographies. You don't get your resume with your birth certificate. You know, you create your life as you did. And the life you create depends on the talents you discover, the opportunities you create, whether you take them or you don't. But human life is a constant process of improvisation. You know, we give in to this idea that it's a linear process because every now and then we have to write our resume and put the whole thing on two sides of paper. And we set it all out like it was some well-planned strategy. You know, going from date to date with some stuff in bold, you leave out the stuff you don't want people to know about because... You know, the last thing you want to do is convey the actual chaos we're living through most of the time. You know, that you you go from, some things draw your attention, some things don't. You grasp at something, you may not get it, you get to something else. Every life is different, and the people who really live lives that they find meaningful and fulfilling are the ones who've tapped into their talents and interests in the best way. So I'm just really saying that we have so much more resources, so much more depth, so much more possibility in our schools and our kids and in our teachers and educators in our communities than we actually take note of. It's like the Earth's natural resources. You know, they're often buried beneath the surface. And if we bring them up and cultivate them, you know, it's astonishing what people are capable of achieving. So, yeah, I do talk in the school about alternative education. And my point is that these are schools or institutions processed to get kids re-engaged with school. And they're very personalized. And they work. It's just curious to me. They're called alternative education. If education was all like that, we wouldn't need the alternative.
Ken Robinson is the creator of probably the best, the most viewed TED Talk ever. It is. It's called Do Schools Kill Creativity? His book with Lou Aronica is called Creative Schools, The Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, swap some stories about education, or ask some questions of Ken and his approach. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from David in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you for having this really relevant topic and Ken, for your advocacy for systemic change. I really appreciate it. In 20 years of teaching, I've gone through No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, and now we're doing Common Core, and in Oregon, Smarter Balanced is our method of testing. And so the names have changed, but really the focus has been the same, which is this ongoing kind of relentless assessment. And I appreciate that you want to change that. As a teacher, you know, if you apply for a job and they ask you how you feel about Common Core, you better say something good, because you're not going to get the job if you say that you're against those kinds of things, or if you'd even just like to see reform in them. So I'm curious how you recommend that teachers who are within the system help to make those changes without creating discord, because when you're within that system and you say anything that's slightly against testing, you have to be on one side or the other, and if you're not supportive of it, it's very difficult. I'm also curious just how you feel about Ben School, that's made every single elementary school a magnet school so that everybody gets a special program, and Ashland Schools that has no charter schools. So if you could address those topics.
All right. Thanks, David.
Okay. Okay. Well, I agree with you about the difficulties that people face. And I was saying right at the beginning that I've worked in education my whole life, and I'm not for a moment being critical of teachers in this. On the contrary, my whole argument is that schools depend upon the quality and commitment and passion of great teachers. There's no school in the world that's better than the teachers who work in it. And the job is about helping kids learn, and that's a really creative profession, and we've all been deeply affected by teachers who do it well and often disaffected by the ones who do it less well. And I think this whole testing movement has misunderstood that that's the critical part of education. You know, it tends to focus on the curriculum or testing rather than on teaching, which is the really, really pivotal process, you know, that turns schools one way or the other. And I know in some areas there is a sensitivity about testing, and you have to say the right things. I'll come back to that in just a minute, but on the Common Core, by the way, you know, people have all kinds of views on the Common Core. I want to separate the issue out a little bit. When I lived in the UK in the late 80s, there was a national curriculum brought into being, and I myself, you know, didn't oppose the idea of a national curriculum. I don't myself feel that there's no place for a common framework of what schools minimally should be covering. That can be helpful. I mean, Finland, which is one of the most successful systems, does have an outline curriculum which schools use as a touchstone. It's not over-prescriptive, and that's the thing. It's a common shared framework of things schools should cover, but it's not prescriptive to the point where schools have got no freedom to work within it. So it's not the idea of a common core that gets me worried. It's you know, the nature of it and what it covers, and if the standards are appropriate and if there are too many of them. The other reason people are concerned about a Common Core is because they're suspicious now about who's behind it, where it came from, what the motives are, and I think people, as you say, are so exhausted after 15 years of testing and No Child Left Behind, they just feel this is just another step too far of government overreach, you know, state and federal, and that they just don't want it. Now, so there's been some resistance to that. I can see why that would be, and I agree with why people are resisting it. But I think it's important not to throw the baby out the bathwater. It's still helpful to have some overall framework. For example, I'm very keen on the importance of the arts alongside the sciences in schools, and I'd like to see that also included in any kind of framework at state or district level to make sure schools are encouraged to do that. On the testing thing, I do agree entirely. It's a sensitive issue, and you have to look at the actual context you're working in. It's not true everywhere. I think the districts are beginning to move in this other direction. Change does happen. People are pulling away from the testing agenda. People are starting to protest about it. There's a shift in the zeitgeist. It may be slow. It may be too slow for individual taste, but these things do shift. And it depends what the context is that you're actually working within. The book is full of examples of schools who are working their way around it, who are taking alternative paths, and there are people who are part of a movement to change the course of testing. So you have to make an individual judgment around this and look at your actual circumstances. At the moment, it's a sad fact that testing still dominates the political and public conversation about education. I'm doing what I can to try and move the conversation in a different direction, and I'm not alone. There are plenty of people doing it, and I do think it's important to be associated with people who are moving in that direction too, if that's one you find more congenial. The point about the book I want to make is that there are It's not a theory. You know that if you're a teacher. There are brilliant schools out there doing wonderful work, and I'm really just showing that there are better ways of doing it and doing my own part to encourage the movement in that direction rather than deeper into the testing culture.
And your focus in the book is generally through high school, and so with the younger students as well. But I mean, one of the things that our last caller was asking about was magnet schools and the value there. What do you see? I mean, when you start talking about ways in which you tailor school experiences more to what the students' desires are or strengths, I mean, how early is too early?
Well, you know, for some kids, it's they find out quite early on there's something they're really passionate about and good at. And you know, I wrote a book a few years ago, you may remember, called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything, about the nature of talent. And some people do come to it quite quickly, and some later on. I think generally we start this conformity process too early. You know, if you look at countries in Scandinavia, often their kids don't start serious study, reading and writing, till they're 6 or 7. I think we're starting it too early. We need to give kids time to grow and develop as children and let their talent start to show themselves.
I noticed that recently, that Finland doesn't really concentrate on reading until age 7, which surprises a bunch of people. Ken Robinson is our guest. His book is Creative Schools, The Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. We'll come back and talk more with him and take more of your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Ken Robinson, PhD, he's Sir Ken Robinson in the UK. He and Lou Aronica wrote a book about schools in the world and how they can be better. Creative Schools, The Grassroots Revolution That Is Transforming Education. You can join this discussion on the Exchange. You might have some questions for Ken about his approach and his ideas, or some stories you can offer from your own life about being around students in schools. Join us at 800-838-3600. 760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to get to one of the other case studies in the book so we can wash the abattoir example away. you bring up Lori Barron, who took over as principal at a middle school in Georgia in a pretty tough district, and describe some of the things she did to change school culture over time.
Yeah, well, Lori, when she went to the school, found... You know, there were lots of problems, lots of behavior problems. Kids were truanting. There were, you know, fights, a lot of disaffection, parental anxieties. School wasn't performing well on the tests either. So standards weren't great on those tests or in other ways. And she said she spent the first year as a principal, as it were, putting out fires, you know, jumping over desks, stopping kids falling out with each other or fighting, writing notes to say they couldn't come to school until this was sorted out. She did all the conventional things. But it dawned on her as the year wore on that it wasn't working, it wasn't the best way, and she talked to all the staff there, some of whom, you know, had been very disaffected as well before she arrived, and they developed this plan, you know, that they realized that all the stuff about curriculum and testing just had to be put on hold for a while, that until they got these kids really engaged and interested in the school and curious to be at school, then everything else was a waste of time and effort. So they did start to develop individual plans for all the students. They made home visits. They spoke to the students about things that interested them. So she said there was one kid there who had been a big problem. He was a statistic, as she said, waiting to happen. But he was passionate about football, so they made sure he had a really good football program to follow. There's another girl who was depressive, very reclusive, but had a passion for music they didn't know about, and so they made sure she had a really good and interesting music program. They did all this, you know, individually. Kids have different interests and so on, and she said, we realized that if we make school compelling for the kids, if they're able to do things that they love, then they're much more likely to do things that we also think are important alongside those, and it turned out that way. You know, the lad who was put on the football program started to do well in his other lessons. He started to turn up more. He started to get better grades. It was true of the music. There are lots of examples like that. The point is, over the course of her 5 years, I think it was, at the school, it went from being one of the lowest performing to one of the best performing schools in the district. There was competition to get to the school. Truancy rates plummeted. Engagement rates went up. Achievement rates were improved. And she said it all happened because we took a close personal interest in the kids as individuals and tried to create a culture in the school where they knew that their talents and passions were actually respected and encouraged. And, you know, as the process went on, Laurie actually was named as the MetLife Principal of the Year. She was given an award for it, and she's now a superintendent in another district where she's helping to apply those principles in other schools. Well, it's just a very good example to me, Jeff, of the fact that education is personal, that what we're talking about is not a theory, that if you personalize education, if you engage kids at the individual level, if you work with the staff collaboratively, teachers do that, if you challenge your own thing about how schools have to be organized, because a lot of what goes on in schools is habit, not requirement. You know, there are all sorts of different ways of doing school, and we have other examples in the book of that. If you do that, if you make it relevant, personal, and customized to those kids in that community, that's really when you start to see the standards going up and levels of achievement going up as well.
How labor-intensive is an approach, though, that is more student-centered like this, and how much, then, does something like large class sizes in American schools get in the way?
Well, teaching is a labor-intensive occupation, however you do it. But it's like all occupations. If you love it, you'll still be energized by it. I mean, I know teachers who work in very difficult areas who go to school every day and love what they do because they're getting the rewards and the results from the kids' engagement and their achievement. But it is a very demanding profession. People who don't know about teaching, I think, often underestimate it. You know, they do all that stereotypical thing. They think, well, look at the school holidays, you know, you get the summer off and all of that. It's a really narrow way to think of teaching. I always say to people who think, well, it must be easy, well, go and do it for a bit and see how you get on with it. You know, it's, you know, when I met my wife, she was teaching in Liverpool. This is nearly 40 years ago now. She was teaching in Liverpool, where we're both from. She had 42 10-year-olds in that class. And it was in a very difficult part of the city, high unemployment, low income, and, you know, a difficult neighborhood. But the school was wonderful. They had a great head teacher who recognized that they needed to really get the culture of the school right, and they worked with the staff. So the teachers all had their own class in the morning and then taught to their particular interests and strengths in the afternoon. So Terry, my wife, she did theater across the school with all the kids and dance, and another teacher who was passionate about math did special math classes in the afternoon for the kids who wanted to take them. The school was just humming. And the thing about it was that what they all understood is that teaching is a sophisticated profession, and there are lots of different strategies. You know, if you stand in front of a classroom of 32, 33, 35 kids, and they're all in desks, and you see the job as teaching from the front and just instructing them, well, you know, that can be a real test for some kid, a real trial if kids aren't naturally inclined to sit still all day. You know, that's a labor-intensive way. If you're spending a lot of your time on crowd control, But if you adopt other approaches as well, not instead of, but as well as, like having practical project work, collaborative work, teamwork, you know, kids working together, then you often get a much more productive atmosphere in the classroom, and it gives you time to go around and work with people individually and in smaller groups, which is what Terry did. And I've seen that happen all the time. There's a school we feature in the book called High Tech High, which is down there in San Diego, and that's largely based, it's a high school, largely based on collaborative teamwork and project-based work, and it's been very, very successful. So there are different ways of doing it. As long as, if we think of school just as people sitting in desks with somebody speaking at the front, that itself can create problems which can be changed or avoided if you alter how you do it.
Are American schools often going about this exactly backwards? I asked this with a particular case in mind. A friend of mine who works as a teacher is aware that in her district, the superintendent expects that, you know, Thursday at 8:30 a.m. in every third grade classroom, I'm going to know what's going on because they're all following the same curriculum. Does it need to be more flexible than that?
Well, I think so. I think so because one of the examples I give in the book about the creativity of teaching, it seems a bit oblique, but it's an interesting example. It's a nice book published a number of years ago called Artistry Unleashed, and it's about artistry in different professions and occupations. And this guy teaches horse riding in the States, and it's a very small example of a woman he was helping to learn to ride, and she came in one day, clearly flustered, and he said, "What's the problem?" And he said, I said, "I don't know." He said, "The horse is all over the place today, and I took it out yesterday, and I did exactly the same thing today, and he was great yesterday, and he just wouldn't behave today." And he thought for a moment. He said, "Well, you know, maybe you were riding yesterday's horse." And that's just a lovely way to put it, isn't it?
When
you're dealing with living people, you know, that kids are affected by everything. The weather, you know, they're affected by, you know, the mood in the classroom, whether something's happened, what's been on the news. You know, they're not motor cars, they're people. And there's feeling in the system. And so teachers do need to be given discretion to modulate what they do and to make judgment calls about, you know, sometimes in a class, the thing you plan to do doesn't quite work, but something else comes up and you should be able to go with that. You know, providing you cover the ground and there's an agreement about where you need to get to. It's like jazz, you know. I mean, how you play the tune may be very different today according to what else is going on. So I think it's a really fine balance to strike between giving people the discretion and the training and the support to do their job we expect of them and a proper frame of accountability. But the problem, I think, often happens in education where administrators go into command and control mode and say, look, this is what you've got to do and this is when you've got to do it. And on the whole, that leads to a more sterile culture than the one I'm advocating anyway.
Let's take a call from Tim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Robinson.
Yes, very quickly. I don't know about, and I know do the other people, how do they learn to anticipate and answer what may be unanswerable questions? Let me give you a quick example. When I was, I'm about 75 years old. In the sixth grade, a lot of kids did not have kindergarten. I did. They kept rote learning, two and two is four, two and two is four. I said, "For what? Why do we need four?" And in various ways, that question has never been answered in any classes that I took, going right on up through some college. There's got to be multiple ways to approach a student's question.
All right. Thank you for that, Jim.
Yes. I think you're exactly right about that, Jim. I mean, firstly, you know, all of these systems, you know, they were developed by people. You know, the world wasn't born with mathematics. We didn't develop calculus till very recently. These systems were born out of the creative inquiry and curiosity of people who were trying to figure something out. And there's a wonderful book I remember reading years ago called Zero, about how, you know, the Romans didn't have the concept of zero, and the development of the concept of zero revolutionized mathematics. You know, math is a highly creative discipline which has evolved over time, you know, in many different cultures in different ways, in answer to what seem to be unfathomable questions. And that's right. If education is based entirely on giving people answers to questions they hadn't thought of, then it becomes a much less interesting process than if you engage them in trying to figure out why we need these things and what it adds up to, you know, as it were. And of course, apart from that, a lot of the most important questions that we face in our lives are not susceptible to one of four choices on a bubble test. You know, questions about purpose and meaning and direction and your own, you know, your own route to living a life that adds up to something. We're all the time being presented with questions that can confound us. And it's why, by the way, we need the arts and humanities in our lives, because that's what these disciplines, particularly the arts, deal with. You know, the questions that don't lend themselves to easy, unambiguous answers.
No, so lots of ways to do things, yeah. So when we get back to the industrial model that led to the school system we have now, the schools essentially grew up with the factories that they were providing workers for. How closely should schools align with the skills that are required in society at a given time versus just providing people who are smart and well-rounded?
Well, it's a balance of all of these things, I think. I'm not trying to present an oversimplified idea, you know, that schools were simply written down as a blueprint based on industrial manufacturing. But I'm saying there was a climate there, a set of economic imperatives which shaped the thinking about schools. Lots of things shaped the way schools have come about. One of them, which seems almost in conflict with it, which I wrote about in another book called Out of Our Minds, is that the curriculum of schools, I mean, organizationally, schools were deeply affected by the same sorts of processes that were underpinning industrialism. But the culture of schools, the emphasis on academic work, is rather curious in a way, isn't it? Because you think if schools are all about helping kids fit into the job market, well, why would we have an academic curriculum? Wouldn't there be a much more practical curriculum? Because in the end, you know, we're so obsessed with academic work, and yet academics are meant to live in ivory towers and not understand the real world at all. You know, it's a very interesting irony. And the reason is that the content of the curriculum was shaped by the universities, you know, in their own interests. Really, school leaving exams are actually university entrance exams. And they're there because universities are trying to get the people they want. And it's why we end up with this system of also-rans. You know, in America particularly, and sadly, it's not only here, but it is true here, there's a terrible divide between academic and vocational programs. You know, if you decide you don't want to go and do an academic degree at college, you actually want to get into the workforce or work with your hands, you know, to apply ideas as an electrician or an engineer or, you know, to go into one of the so-called, you know, applied professions. You're not particularly encouraged to do that because the emphasis is all on getting people into college and to do these other sorts of degrees. You know, originally that was true. And there is a sense in which people who want to get out into the job market are thought of as also-rans, you know, that, you know, like it's that thing about hockey and basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So education has, and it's what I argue in the book, education has several things to it. One of them is economic, and yes, we should be looking at the sorts of skills and aptitudes that our students will need now to make their way in a world that's very different from the 19th and 20th century. And you know, there are other sorts of skills. Creativity is high among them. You know, collaboration, teamwork, all these things are highly valued by employers. But there are social and cultural and personal purposes too. And getting that balance right is really the whole trick here. And it's what the book is encouraging schools to do.
Lots of great examples of places where creative schools already exist from Ken Robinson. The book is called Creative Schools, The Grassroots Revolution, that's transforming education. Ken Robinson, thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
I really appreciate you. Thank you so much.
All right, take care.